I thought you had me pegged as having been in the military by the statement you made a little earlier, and I was. I spent quite a bit of time in the Air Force. And I thought I'd read you a little excerpt here, The Operation of the Chain of Command. Or another title, It Happens Every Day, Even Among the Best. The colonel called his executive officer in and said this, At 9 o'clock tomorrow, there will be an eclipse of the sun, something which does not occur every day. Get the men to fall out in the company street in their fatigues so that they will see this rare phenomenon, and I will explain it to them. In case of rain, we will not be able to see anything, so take the men to the gym. Yes, sir. So the exec called the company commander in and told the captain this. By order of the colonel, tomorrow at 9 o'clock there will be an eclipse of the sun. If it rains, you'll not be able to see it from the company street, so then in fatigues, the eclipse of the sun will take place in the gym. Something which does not occur every day. Yes, sir. Well, the captain called the platoon leader in and told the lieutenant this. He said, By order of the colonel, in fatigues tomorrow at 9 o'clock in the morning, the inauguration of the eclipse of the sun will take place in the gym. The colonel will give the order if it should rain, something which does not occur every day. The lieutenant then told the sergeant this. He said, Tomorrow at 9 o'clock, the colonel, in fatigues, will eclipse the sun in the gym. As it occurs if it's a nice day, but if it rains, then in the company street. Yes, sir. So the sergeant called a corporal in and said, Tomorrow at 9, the eclipse of the colonel in fatigues will take place by cause of the sun. If it rains in the gym, something which does not take place every day, you will fall out in the company street. And this is what the privates were saying among themselves. Well, tomorrow if it rains, it looks as if the sun's going to eclipse the old man in the gym. Boy, it's a shame that doesn't happen every day. So, you know, communication gets garbled, doesn't it? I just told my wife the other day, I said, You certainly look lovely today. And she said, Today. You know, the words, she received them differently than I communicated them. I had something in mind to transmit. Has that ever happened to you? You say a thing. And somebody reacts, Hey, that's a lovely red dress. You don't like blue? Well, you know, I didn't mention blue. I just like the red. Well, people respond differently. And have you heard things like, I'm not angry. Nothing. What's the matter with you? Nothing. We see things and we perceive things. There's communication going on all the time. I would submit that communication is a lot like behavior. Among psychologists, they say it's impossible to have no behavior because no behavior is a type of behavior. And even silence is a type of communication, isn't it? So it's a very complex subject. I think English makes it much more difficult. There are several other languages in the world I don't think has quite the confusion that English has with it. I think that many of the things I learned in Germany, they seem to have a little more preciseness and some of their language. And I notice some Asian languages are not confused that much because their vocabulary is more limited and they have precise things that mean things. And the same word like blue and blue doesn't mean two different things. They're not. But even among those people, you'll find that communication problems do come up. Well, in order to deal with this, I have a little handout that we're going to fill it in, and we're going to fill it in slowly. So when you see the first overhead, don't panic. Try to fill it in all at once. Because there'll be plenty of time for that. Let's see. We'll need two more there. My name is Bill Threlkell. And if you can't pronounce it, I can understand why. I asked my grandmother when she was 82, how do you pronounce that name? And she wasn't sure. So don't hold me for that. Threl, we say Threl, and Keld is Kel. So it's a Scandinavian name. I think the Norse invasion of Wales, it was spelled differently. Then the Welsh have been known to mess things up, a lot like the Marine Corps will do in the military. No, I'm sorry I said that. But I love the Marines, and I love the Welsh, too. So my name really, it came over here from as an offshoot of a Welsh name. I'm responsible for a program with the Navigators called Missionary Associates. That's a tent-making missionary effort where a person uses their profession to get a job in a given nation and then uses that job both for support and to get a visa. When you consider there are 47 nations officially closed to missionaries today out of 191. At least that's what the mission handbook declares, 191 nations. 47 officially closed. There's another 30 or 40 that are partially closed. They have great restrictions. Very difficult to get in. So when you add that up, we're looking at nearly half the nations of the world. The number is increasing, not decreasing. So this is our approach, the Navigator's approach, to what to do, particularly from a closed country standpoint. But we also find out that it's very beneficial for our open countries, where we can get people readily. We can beef up our ministry team that way. Take good, solid laymen who have grown in the Lord, who have helped someone else to grow that way, so they've already done here what we want them to do there. And my job is to recruit those people, evaluate them, maybe assist some with training, then help them get located overseas in places where we would like them to go. We have nearly 100 of those people in 32 different nations. And we've been behind the Iron Curtain and the Bamboo Curtain and throughout the Middle East. So you can see that it really is a appropriately functioning approach. We even have several in Australia. We have a computer programmer, and then we have we had a professor who went over to teach a specialized subject. Well, let's begin by looking at maybe to see if we can get some definition for what we mean by communication, at least for purposes for this morning. One definition that I particularly liked was that communication is made possible through the medium of the communicator, the person. A living person. The way to establish communication is through the communicator himself or herself. It's the person that really counts so much. It's not just what's said. It's not just writing words down, but communication is imparting of the person. A lot of feeling, a lot of the ideas, a lot of the personality. There's so many things involved. For the message and the messenger must become one. What happens when they don't? They believe what they've seen, not what they've heard. It's how they perceive it that counts. It's not so much what you said, maybe, as it was the way that you said it. What they received on the other end. When the message is incarnated, is made alive in the messenger, the message is not an idea. It's an event. It's a happening. It's an interaction. And therefore, the title, Interpersonal Communication This Morning, because it's an interaction among people. It's not sterile. It's alive. The name of that hotel? Dragnet. What did he want? The facts. Only want the facts, sir. Well, we want a lot more than facts this morning. I'll leave that on a few minutes. And the approach that I'd like for us to take is going to be in this little communications handout. What I would propose for us to do is use this as an outline. I tell you what, for the sake of time, if you would like to copy this, I'll have it available afterwards. I think that let me press on with some of this other information. If you would like that at the end, I'll be glad to put it back up. You may have to remind me to put it back up. I tend to forget these days. I got a letter from a dear lady in Florida. She was in her late 80s. She says, I'm in standing in front of the refrigerator with the door open. Did I put it in or do I need to take it out? She said, then I went in the next room and I'm standing at the foot of the stairs. Do I need to go up or did I just come down? And then she says, I finally finished this letter to you, son. I put a stamp on it and took it down to the post office and opened it and read it. So I said, well, maybe it's not as bad as I thought. So if you feel free to remind me, and if you have questions or comments you want to make, I would encourage you to do that. The process, I think, will help us to understand interpersonal communications. What we really would like to have happen when we communicate is a response. Let's see if I can straighten that up a little. We have a sender and a receiver, and this sender would like this receiver to have some kind of a response. I use the word reaction. I think if when I redo this transparency, I'll put the word response. Reaction may have a negative implication to it when it's really not intended to be negative. Now, the goal that this sender has is really to see this reaction or this response in the part of the receiver. Then the action that takes place in order to help that get achieved, we might call the process. What happens? What is the action that we go through that helps to the goal to be achieved over here? There's a motivation. You want some response on the part of the receiver. It might be understanding. It might be clarification. It might be emotion. It might be fear, anger, any numbers of things. But there's some objective here, and it's normally the response on the part of the receiver. Now, to trace this out, the sender has... Now, that light bulb is probably deceiving. What does it imply to you? An idea. And that's part of it. But there's more than the idea. It's how you feel about that idea. It's the idea and the feeling. I had a young man some years ago made a statement, and I was trying to get at the heart of it. And three times I asked questions to try to get at the heart of it. He said, "That's the third time you've tried to pursue that." And I stated as clearly as I can. I said, "Yeah, you really did. And I think I understood what you said. What I don't know is how you felt about it." I said, "Would you believe that I personally am a lot more interested, not in what you said, but in how you felt about what you said?" Does that make sense? We'll talk some more about that a little later. But it's the idea and the feeling. Now, in order to get it from here to there, there's a process that we probably need to go through. Now, the first thing we have on this block diagram, I've entitled personal barriers, but you notice another one over here. Why would there be two personal barriers listed in a block diagram? The sender and receiver. Which set of barriers are the most significant? I think from the standpoint of getting your message across, it's the receiver, isn't it? But that's from the standpoint of me being able to do that, then I have to get through my own barriers, don't I? So what we're saying is just what you said, both the sender and the receiver. Of course, there's a message, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. There's some physical barriers, things that tend to interrupt from a physical standpoint in the communication process. And then there's a channel. And we'll see that channel then as a combination of one or more of our senses. Well, let's look at, as we begin to fill in, I don't want to forget an important thing, and that all the time that you're having sending and receiving, there's a feedback line. The receiver's giving feedback. He may verbalize it, or he may not. It might be with a frown. It might be a nod of the head. Might even be looking at the watch. You get signals. There's feedback. Well, let's begin then by looking at some of the barriers, and don't be concerned about the number of them here. We're going to take them, a few of them at a time. And whose barriers should we focus on in order to ensure that we really get our message across? Okay, now that is as I'm sending. What about in order for that message to be received? Suppose they have a barrier and I perceive it. Then what should I do? I'll have to focus ultimately on the personal barriers of the receiver. I think I began by looking at my own personal barriers. And then, to ensure it all, I need to look at the personal barriers of the receiver. Let's take them one at a time. Now, like I said, there's no point to try to copy them down all at once, but because we're going to talk about them. The first part of this, now we're going to talk about some concepts. And the second part, there'll be a lot of application of them. We're going to have a lot of interaction. So they're really almost two different presentations. The first is some information, and the second is some application. There'll be some application in the first, but it's not quite as pronounced, I don't think. Communicative skill. Whose communicative skill am I going to have to be sure that I take care of in order to be understood? When I say understood, I'm talking about that they hear what I say and respond to it the way I would like. I need to start with mine, but what's going to determine my skill? I'm going to suggest that the primary focus for most of these are going to have to be on the receiver. If I understand what his skill level is, it will make a big difference, won't it? Have you thought a lot about that? What language patterns do you use? What skills do you exhibit? When you talk to a child, do you talk to a child in different language than you do to an adult? Some people do, some don't. If you talk to someone who has knowledge in your background, you can use certain terminology. If they don't know, then you have to be careful of that. Now, we have cross-cultural language here today. We have someone from Australia. And I learned from some dear friends of mine that it's a total misconception for an American to assume that they speak Australian-type English, even though most of the words are understood. Many of the feelings are misunderstood. And an American will go over to Australia and say things and think, well, I've been heard and I've been understood. Yes, but you've been misunderstood so frequently. And then we'll misunderstand the answer because the feelings are different. There's strong cultural overtones. A lot of things will affect my communicative pattern. But I need to try to practice my skill for the receiver. I need to gear it. Now, if you had to choose one or the other, if you had to speak just a little above someone's head, as far as the term we mean, speaking over someone's head means speaking a little higher level language as opposed to speaking below them. Which one would you choose if you're not sure what their language skill is? Most people would say below, and most of us probably would do that. Now, if the other person catches you at that, how will they feel about that? You're dead. I think that's true. If you speak a little over their head, you'll probably be able to pick it up at some point in time. How will they feel about that? That you spoke a little over their head. If they can track you most of the way, I don't think there'll be a strong negative. But you'll be able to pick up from some feedback from most people, won't you? A little frown or maybe some little feedback symbols that you may be speaking over their head. And you change the pattern. And most of the time people don't get upset with that, but if they catch you speaking down to them, you've probably lost it. And it'll take you some time to recover that. So what you want to be careful of in the use of this pattern is that you don't turn off by the barriers on this side. For example, values are very important to communication. Some years ago, my wife and I represented the Navigators at the University of Tennessee. And one of my daughters was a schoolmate with me. I was going to grad school and she was in undergraduate school, and we had some interaction with a hippie on campus. And after I'd had that interaction, my daughter had some discussion with me about that. And he violated my basic values. He was dirty and scroungy and his language was terrible and he was spaced out. He made all kinds of accusations and false statements and a lot of other stuff. And I had a hard time tracking with him. And it really showed after it was over. My daughter said, Daddy, you acted like you didn't even like that guy. Then I had to think, did I dislike him? No, I don't think I disliked him, but I greatly disliked the things that he stood for. He violated my value system, and I reacted and violated his values. And as soon as I violated his values, what happened to our conversation? It ended. So I don't have to accept his values, but I need to be sensitive to him as a person. Have to be real careful about the value system. Nobody's asking you to change your values, but I think to be accepting of the person. It's sort of like the sin and the sinner. I think you can accept the sinner and still hate the sin. But value systems, and they're so sensitive. Boy, when you violate a key value, what happens to you when somebody violates one of your key values? Boy, you flare inside, your voice rises, you speak faster, you get an intense look on your face, sometime the thing will come out there, and occasionally, but you can sure turn it off if you don't recognize that values are very meaningful to the receiver. And I've learned to say something like, well, I've heard that statement before. That doesn't mean that I agree with it, you see. Somebody says, oh, I don't believe that there's a God. And I'll tell you one real happening. A fellow said, oh, I don't believe the Bible. You believe the Bible? Do you believe the Bible personally? How does this affect you to hear somebody say, I don't believe the Bible? How do you feel about that? Well, you might pass it off, but if he looked you right in the eye and leaned forward and said, I don't believe the Bible, how do you feel about that? Well, you know what I told him? I smiled. I said, it's true anyway. It's true anyway. Let me tell you about some of the Bible. That his value was the Bible wasn't true, and I know that it's true. So I can't be offensive with that. I might have said something like, well, I've heard that before. Let's see, in one case with a fellow, I said, let me show you some truth that is truth, that you've always known is truth, and you've never ever questioned in all of your life. How's that for a challenge? The guy who says the Bible's not true. Smile when you say that, see. Otherwise, it's argumentative, isn't it? Already we're introducing nonverbal to go with the verbal. If your nonverbal contradicts your verbal, what will they believe? They'll believe the nonverbal, almost invariably. So I tried to keep it friendly, and I showed him a passage in Proverbs, you know. It says, surely the churning of milk brings forth butter. Didn't you know that? I said, Randy, didn't you know that? Haven't you known that all your life? He said, yeah. Did you ever question that it's true or not? He said, no. I said, I knew that. I knew that you knew that. So you'll have to recognize that's truth, won't you? I said, read on. The twisting of the nose brings forth blood. Didn't you know that? If you didn't get blood, you didn't twist it hard enough. Twist harder. You get blood, believe me. Boy, if you've ever had a nosebleed, it's easy to get blood. If you didn't get it, a little harder will do it. You knew that, didn't you? He said, yeah. Forcing of wrath brings forth strife. Didn't you know that? You ever been in a fight? He said, yeah. Well, lots of times. I said, how'd you get into them? He said, that's the way. I said, you knew that, didn't you? He said, yeah. Here's something else you know. For all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. Didn't you know that? Do you know anybody who's perfect? You see, and we led into it on a more pleasant basis, not really trying to defend the issue, not trying to be argumentative, considering that his values were different from mine. I just wanted to support mine. I may have to listen to his in order to... I've traded that off. Have you ever traded it off? You might want to try that sometime. A Muslim was going to try to convert me to Islam one day. I said, I think I see what you're doing, and I'm willing for you to do it. Why don't we take turns? You be first. And we reached an agreement. But that's recognizing that values are important. Knowledge and experience go hand in glove. You've noticed that, haven't you? If you're going to talk about a thing, is there a musician in here? Someone who studied music? A crescendo, does that mean anything to you?
Sure.
Yeah. Sure, it's an increase. Did that mean, did you understand crescendo? Poco a poco. That's not so common a term. Okay, see, there's things that communicate. But that's because you picked up on that. Somebody in electronics in here. Okay, so what's somebody's, anybody, so what's some, one of your fields, somebody, something that you're involved in?
Theology.
All right, if you talk to a non-theologian. And you used premillennial. That question was brought up this past week. Oh, what's your stand? And the answer was premillennial. Does that mean something? What would it mean to someone who doesn't know any theology? It would be kind of confusing, wouldn't it? At best. So you see the idea. If you want to be understood over here, who do you have to focus on with your terminology to cover your knowledge and experience? Something that they understand, that they can relate to. But it's amazing how many of us focus on our own thing. We have our own language patterns for where we are. Even our own church, our denomination has acronyms. Have you noticed how many of those go floating around? The NAVs have got them all over the place. TMS, the ABCs, the B rations. On and on. The 2-7. But if I want to be understood, I've got to recognize and focus on the other person's knowledge and experience level. Suppose that I don't know. Let's even summarize up to now that I really don't know any of the above. What the communication skill level is of the person, their knowledge or their experience or their values. How will I find out? Do you agree to that? Are we good question answers? Askers? Well, most of us probably are. The next question, are we good listeners? I'm not sure. You'll have to answer that question. My wife is a fantastic listener. It's been pointed out to me that I am probably not that good a listener. And it's amazing when people want to be heard. Who do they talk to? They talk to her. Attitudes are very important, but I would submit that in order to get a proper attitude there, I probably need to start with a good attitude on this end. I need to be very sensitive that my attitude's okay. See, if that guy said, but I don't believe the Bible. If I'd have said, you don't? I thought every man in his right mind believed in the Bible. I would express an attitude that probably did what? Cut it off again. The physical senses. Somebody spoke to me this past week. It's in the grocery store. I heard something over there. And then he walked around a little bit more and spoke it again. He was asking me a question. Did I want a paper sack or a plastic sack for the groceries? Reasonable question. When he finally got my peripheral vision, I turned to look at him. And he had asked the question twice, like, what's the matter with you, dummy? He didn't ask that, but I was wondering if he was thinking that. And I said, well, this is my deaf ear. And it really is. I'm not 100% deaf in it, but I'm about 50% deaf in it. And if there's background noise, I may not hear it all from my left side. But when he wanted my attention, then what? I'll overshoot a little bit and make sure my right ear is toward him. Well, I'm compensating because I've got a physical sense problem. Does that matter? Suppose someone does have a physical sense problem. They don't see well. Or they don't hear. I walked into the University of Tennessee some years ago, and there were two men standing right there in the foyer. And they were going, well, I don't know that two-hand deal, but in the Boy Scouts years ago, I learned how to fingerspell. So I looked at them when they saw me come in. I said, that's H-I. I said, one of them looked at me and he said, and then the other fellow said, oh, do you communicate with the deaf? Well, then I had it figured out, you know, which was which. I thought they could have been both students because we had a deaf ed. They could have both been deaf and trying to communicate with one another. One of them could have been an interpreter and the other a student, and that was the last case. But I didn't know that when I started. I wanted to begin some kind of a contact with them, communication-wise, so I said, hi. And I said, I'm Bill. And he said he was Jerome. And we shook hands. That fella was in the same graduate program that I was in. I later found out. We took a class together. And we got to be friends. He could read my lips. He could not read most people's lips, but he could read mine. So between lip reading and some fingerspelling and a little writing, we got to communicating fairly well. But I had to recognize that he couldn't hear. He asked me to be his interpreter for one or two courses and let the other guy go. He would communicate his comment, and I would raise my hand, then I'd point to Jerome, and I'd say, Jerome has a comment. And I'd make it, and he'd nod his head. Now, I felt that focusing on his communication physical sense problem was an important thing to do, but I really liked the guy. Now, he could talk, but he was absolutely deaf, couldn't hear a sound. But he had learned the nasal sound. You know how a lot of deaf people, because they can't hear their own feedback. So he was willing to talk to me, but not in a group. And he wouldn't say, talk like this. One day that I wanted to talk with him, and I asked him to stay behind after class. I wanted to communicate the gospel to him. So I told him, I said, GODLOVESU. He said, I know that. He said, I know that. How? H-O-W. He said, the first time I touched you to get your attention, you did not back away from me. Everybody backs off when I touch them. You get that message? Everybody backs off when he touches them. I didn't back off. I wasn't aware that I'd not. I didn't feel like backing off. I cared for Jerome. I loved him. He was a lovable guy. And he allowed me to share the gospel all the way through with him. And that was a delight just to be able to do that. But I think that I have to be sensitive then to pick up on what's going on with the person. And what's the best way to do that? I think we need to pray our way through it. Now, Colossians 4:6. Is a passage that I think would be helpful for us. Colossians 4:6. Has someone found that? You have that? All right, sir. Please.
Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned, as it were, with salt, so that you may know how you should respond to each person.
Whose speech? Do you read the Bible in the first person? For a number of years, I did not. When the Bible said you, I used to think us. I changed that a little later. When it said you, he's talking about me. Unless I can see that it is to a group. Now, in some cases, that's clear that it's a broad group. But in many cases, it's a personal response. The Scriptures are saying from God to me. He said, let your speech. Then my prayer was, Lord, let my speech. Have you ever prayed this verse in your life? If you haven't, let's take a moment here to do it. If you're inclined, don't do it because I'm saying so. But if you've never done it, I think this is an opportunity to pray this in this Scripture into your life. Here's what I'd suggest. Let me tell you what I did. This really spoke to my heart some years ago, and I said, Lord, please, you give me speech that's with your grace. It's your grace and my speech. Lord, I'm asking that you give me speech that's with your grace. Season my speech with salt. And I thought for a minute about salt. What do you think of when you season something with salt? What happens to it?
Flavor.
What about, describe it more. What other thoughts do you get about salt?
It's flat.
It's what?
Flat.
Okay, without it, it's flat. So the antithesis. Some other feelings about seasoning with salt?
Preserve.
Okay. Now, what does the flavor do not only for that food that you had it on? It may even affect other foods that you have because you can taste that. And it affects everything round about it, all the foods that you put in there. So, season with salt. And I ask for that. Lord, give me speech that's with your grace and season my speech with salt. And then show me how I should answer every person that I come in contact with. Help me with my communication. Give me words that are palatable, that are acceptable, that are not offensive. If the Scriptures cut a man to pieces, that's between him and God. If I cut him to pieces, that's probably between God and me. And then I may need to pray defensively, Lord, please prevent me from having speech that goes out on my own outside of your grace, and that I allow some sin issue to flare in my life that would prevent me from having seasoned speech. That would not be loving and acceptable. Remove that from my life and give me speech that's seasoned with salt. If there's one passage for this seminar, that's what I would suggest, Colossians 4:6. And if you've never memorized it, I'd suggest you put that in your memory packet. Let your speech be, or let my speech be always with grace, seasoned with salt, that I may know how to answer every person. That's beyond my capability to communicate with every person, but it's not beyond God's capability. And that's why I'm suggesting that you ask, how are you going to find out these senses, physical conditioning, the communicative skill, the knowledge and experience? God can show you and then show you how to respond to it. If someone's real tired, you may have to wait on them to rest. If they're thirsty, you might have to wait till they get something to drink before you continue with the communication. If they're ill, you ever tried to communicate to someone who's really feeling bad? Boy, it's so easy to miss the target then. You might have to wait till later. Semantics and verbalism, the use of words, words, words. We depend upon them so heavily when there may be other things to demonstrate. Some nonverbal to go with it, a smile, a pat on the back. A demonstration of the thing, more than just words. Now, whose interests are key here to be able to get across your message? I had just a few minutes this morning with a man that's really a joy to my heart because I was privileged to share Christ with him a number of years ago and then disciple him. And he later became director of personnel at Peterson Air Force Base. And now he has a very prominent job with Hewlett-Packard. He's retired from the Air Force. We had a little prayer time and discussed some problems. In fact, he's given a workshop in the castle now. But the point with him was, in the early phases, he had never been involved in evangelism. His first outing, we had some prayer time and we committed it to God and we went out. And we were both active duty in the Air Force at the time. And we were both officers, and we went to an enlisted barracks. We were not in uniform, so it didn't make that big a difference. And I found this fellow who was coming in with from a track deal. It's pretty prominent today, but in those days, that's been 15 years or so. He had matching shoes and shorts and jackets and the whole thing, and he had duffel bags. This man was really into this running business. I said, "Oh, are you? You've been jogging? Yeah. Are you into track?" Absolutely. That was his thing. And I said, "Well, I understand the Southeast Conference track meet is going to be here in Montgomery this coming week." "Oh, yeah, and then he's off and running." And I said, "It seemed like Florida and Alabama were the two that were favored. How do you feel about that?" "Well, he's got his own opinions," and this guy went on, and we picked up from that and got some other interest going, and then we led into spiritual things and shared the gospel with him. But we picked up, communications-wise, on his interest. His interest was track. And after it's over, the man that I had the time with this morning, he says, "Bill, I didn't know you had an interest in track." I said, "Me? An interest in track? Never." He said, "Well, you sure acted like you did." I said, "Bob, you didn't understand. He had an interest in track. I had an interest in him." There's a message there, a deep-rooted message. See, how am I going to be able to unlock from this, my point of interest, over to his point of interest, and to be sincerely interested? Well, if I'm really interested in him, then I'll be interested in what he has to say and what he's feeling and what he's thinking about. So that's what I would suggest. Emotions are also significant. Have you ever noticed how emotion clouds the picture? When somebody gets angry, what do they hear? Very little. You say, "Well, if I was prepared, it wouldn't bother me." I don't think that's true. For most people, it certainly isn't. One professor, this was given as a true incident. I can't support that it was, but it was recorded as being true. That a professor at a major school was teaching a class on observation. I think it was under the heading of logic. And the particular area of the course that he'd been given instruction in how to be observant, how to pay attention and look, how to remember some memory factors, and then some practice in actually recording what you had observed. He went through that, explained and demonstrated and illustrations, and they'd done homework. And the next to the last class period, he was lecturing. And he was still on the subject. And then out of nowhere, the door in the back of the room flew open and banged against the wall. Bang! Everybody turned around and looked, and there's a man standing there with a pistol. Silence. He walked, there was an aisle right down the center of the class. He walked, came slowly down the aisle, looking at the professor all the time, and he got up fairly close. He says, "I told you the last time I saw you that if I ever caught you messing around my wife again, you were going to pay for it." Blam! And the guy grabbed himself and fell over, and his shirt was all red, and some people screamed in the class, and the assailant turned and ran. And of course they ran up to see if he was alive or dead, and when they were all gathered around and sufficiently involved, he gets up and brushes off the ketchup and says, "Now record what you observed," and he walked out of the class. That was their final examination. Would you believe the shots varied from 1 to 3? There were 30-some students in the class. One joker had him being stabbed. And nobody in the class got the exact quote. He'd memorized the script, and nobody got all the words correct. Why? Emotions were so high, you could not receive the communication. So if someone is having high emotions, you may have to wait a little while. Calm them down. Do it tomorrow or next week. And husband and wife, for goodness sakes, when somebody's flared, let's don't try to press the issue. Let's calm down and quieten down and come at it again. When emotions are not so high. Of course, focusing on the other person's needs, whatever you perceive as a need in their life, well, it's not a marriage seminar, but it's related. And social, cultural norms. Have you noticed that people from, quote, different sides of the track respond differently? Even from different parts of the country? Even if I'd have told you I'm from Maine, would you have believed that? I was privileged to speak at a conference in Massachusetts several years ago. And after I'd gone a little way, I said something like, "Well, I'm confident that by now all of you can tell, I think I said, all y'all can tell that I'm from Maine. Place broke up. They knew that I was not from Maine. Why? Well, there's certain patterns. Where would you assume that I was from if I hadn't told you? From the South somewhere. Somebody said, Bill, you've been out here for 8 or 9 years and you still got grits in your mouth. I said, where did you get the wild idea I'm trying to get rid of them? See, if I went home, it doesn't make a whole lot of difference out here. People tend to receive me okay out here, with or without it. But back home, the social, cultural norm is that I don't talk like some other people. I've got to talk this way when I go home. Well, if that's a group I want to communicate with, then that's probably okay. If it's not, then I might have to make some other changes. All right, that's... There are other things. You might want to put et cetera in the blocks, but those are enough for now. There are physical barriers. For example, I'm going to snap my finger now. At that particular moment that my finger snapped, how many of you were consciously aware that the motor's going on that machine? Okay. How many of you have been aware sometime this morning that that motor's going on it? See, it does make a difference, doesn't it? And if you get the focusing on the motor, you miss much of the communication. Light. When I came in the room, the most of the time that I've had a seminar, I've been down at this end. And I, in my mind's eye, I had, that was my mental set. When I came in, I was down on this end. That's fine. There's no problem. The thing I wanted to be sure of, that none of you were looking into the light. Why?
Distractions.
Does that matter? Boy, something goes by. Suppose I were talking and I did that. What would you want to do? Right. Of course, comfort, if it's too warm or too cold, you know what difficulties there are. Acoustics. Is it bouncing off the wall? We get just a little echo in here, but not a lot. If there were a lot of echo, then you may listen to the echo and get thoroughly distracted. And again, that's a list that probably goes quite a ways. Now, very quickly, we're going to put in these other two, and then we're going to break the pattern. We're going to change it significantly. We talked about ideas and feelings. And I suggested that feelings were going to be a prime portion. Suppose that I was having a conversation with you and you said something and you said, why are you angry? And I said, I'm not angry. Where did you get that idea? Would you believe that I'm not angry? No, you wouldn't. Suppose I said, this is the saddest day of my life. Would you believe that? No, you wouldn't believe that. I don't look sad. And just telling you is not enough. Now, this really happened. I was given a different type seminar to a group of navigator managers, really. And there was one fellow in there that was an engineer by background. And he was trained the facts, sir, and only the facts. We were in a semicircle so everybody could see everybody. And I picked up from his responses that he was a facts-only type fellow. And I walked up to him and I called the subject. I said, I'd like to mention a subject, and if you would, tell me how you feel about it. So I called it by name. Let's say it was fishing. How you feel about that? Here's what he said. He said, I like it. Then I said to the whole group, I said, no more communication on a scale of 1 to 10. 1 meaning he really doesn't like it hardly at all. And 10, it's the greatest thing in his life. Come up with a number that you perceive from the communication. And it went from 2 to 4. Except for one guy who said 8. Now, I could have ruined the communication. I could have said 8. Boy, that would have shut him down, wouldn't it? And that would have closed the seminar. That's what that would have done. But instead, I smiled at him gently, and I said, well, it was evident from the numbers that yours was significantly higher than most of the rest of the people. What prompted you to select 8? Ain't that a lot more gentle way to say that? I said, 8? And he said, well, I know the guy. I've known him for years. I know pretty well how he feels about it. How's that for an answer? Then I turned to the man. I said, you're the only one who has a keyed response. What is the correct answer? He said, 7. Then I felt I needed to jolt a little bit there. I said, well, you know, I really think it should have startled you to recognize that we don't believe you. See, we don't really believe that you like it 7. We believe more like three. And as a result of that, he came back to seek out why that was so, and I put him on video. And as a result of some extra outside training by using that by video, that thing is can be brutal, but it can be very helpful. I call that self-confrontation. But his wife was able to tell me when they moved from here that he was a different guy. He was communicating differently with her. He just never had perceived his own communication pattern. The feelings, you see what I'm saying? It's not so much what you said as it was the way that you said it. Would you believe that from 40 up to 80% of the impact of communication comes from the nonverbal? Up to 80%. It wasn't just what you said, it was the way that you said it. And you don't have to shout it. You can say something like, I've made up my mind about this, and I'm not willing to change my mind. Now, on a scale of 1 to 10, how would you construe that commitment? Or you could say, I'm not willing to change my mind. That's a lot different, isn't it? Well, I'm not willing to change my mind. See, I've moved it down the scale. I mean, you might could persuade me, that last one. And I said basically the same thing. I changed the manner in which I said it. That's so important. That's the message. The message is the idea and the feelings. It's not only what your idea you have, but how do you feel about it, and can the other person perceive it then by the use of various channels or senses. Now, of the senses there, there's one verbal and the rest of them nonverbal. How do we respond to all that? Well, most of us still rely primarily on the verbal. If I'll just describe it fully enough. I got a pastor friend. He is a delightful man. He and his wife, we've had a long-standing relationship. They moved out here with us to learn to become disciple makers and did in fact. And he's back now pastoring the church and making disciples in the church context. And we're just overjoyed. But the man has almost no fluctuation in his communication pattern. He tells he's probably the most exacting truthful man that I've ever known. He spends great time to make sure he's got the truth as center line as he can get it. I'd submit that he probably overdoes that. But he has no nonverbal to go with it. So he was being interviewed, and I told the interviewer, don't take your feeling. You ask him to describe how he feels. But I would have much preferred that he use something more than the verbal. Now, let's pause right there and stand about a minute and get some blood circulating and a little more mountain air and break the pattern, because we're going to change the mode. It's going to be a physical transition into another pattern. Have you heard the story about the 10-speed bicycle? How many have heard that story? About a 10-speed bicycle, man riding a 10-speed bike? Okay, well, why don't we sit down and I'll start this little pattern with this story about a young man in Tennessee who bought him a 10-speed bicycle, and he set out to drive the mountains, the Appalachian chain there. He got so tired of paddling that thing that he just couldn't do it anymore, so he pulled it over to the side of the road and leaned it against a tree and began to try to hitchhike. He wanted a truck to stop. No trucks came by. Nobody stopped. Finally, a man in a brand new Porsche stopped. He said, well, I'd like a ride. Okay, hop in. He said, but I need to take my bike. He said, well, I'm not going to scratch my brand new Porsche with that bicycle. Well, they talked about it a little while, and then the driver said, wait a minute. I've got this little tiny nylon rope. It's not much bigger than a string, but it's strong as a cable. It's about 20 feet long. Why don't I tie one end around the front of your handlebars, and the other end I'll tie to my back bumper, and you can sit there. You don't have to pedal. You just steer it, and I'll drive about 15 miles an hour. You get down that next little town, I'll let you off. And if you want to stop, you've got that little horn there on the handlebars. You just blow that horn, and I'll stop and let you off. He said, nah, that's great. So he climbed on, and everything went swell for 4 or 5 miles, and the driver is going real slowly, very slowly. He's looking at the countryside, and out of nowhere came a Jag. I mean, pulled up there beside him, gear down. Hidden, hidden, hidden. Honk, honk. Hidden, hidden. Popped it in gear. Zoom, he's gone. Pop, he's in there right behind you. Man, they're tracking around the curves and over the hills. They go blazing through that town. And the policeman there, he went zoom, zoom. I mean, he couldn't even start his engine. But he gets on the radio and calls the next town to the policeman down there. Hey, Joe, this is Mike. Listen, I clocked a Jag at 70 right through the heart of town. And right behind him was a Porsche doing the same. And you're not going to believe this, but there was a guy on a 10-speed bicycle tailgating that Porsche, just blowing his horn trying to pass. Well, you know, that might not have been exactly the way it was, but that's how it was perceived. The policeman reported what he thought he had seen. He couldn't see that little rogue. Either one of the drivers would have given you a different story. And I know that the man on that bicycle, his viewpoint was different from anybody's, because he perceived it differently. All of the people involved perceived it differently. Have you ever seen that happen in communication? How does that occur? Let's talk a little bit about perception. Now, if we actually recognize that that is one pattern of the communication process, and that these things can be barriers, personal barriers and physical barriers, we still want this message to go through the channel to get over here to the receiver so he has the right feelings and responses. Now, that's if it's negative. Suppose you understand these things and use them. Is it a barrier then? There would be something positive. I haven't come up with a good word. Maybe if one comes to your mind, you might share it with me. But if above personal barriers, you might want to put the word perception, or perception base, or base of perception, that these things in your life, and when you consider these things in the receiver's life, gives you a better perception as to what to do and how to do it. Perception is key to the communication. You got to perceive the person, you got to perceive their needs, their communicative skills, their knowledge, all these things we talked about is perception. Now, let's talk more about perception as a separate issue, because I think it's valuable. In order to do that, I'd like to begin with a bit of a test. It's a one question test. And I'd like you to review that test question and select the response that you feel is most appropriate answer. Which one does not belong?
Yo-yo.
The yo-yo. How many feel that the yo-yo is the one that doesn't belong? Why would the yo-yo not belong in that group?
Has nothing to do with electricity.
Well, you know, really, that one lights up. You see that? You see the light come on? That's electric yo-yo. It's a shame all of you got the answer wrong. Have you ever seen it? Have you ever had a professor who did that to you? He's perceiving it one way that's vastly different from the rest of the student body, and he won't change his mind. Usually he won't. Some will. Now, that's a trick question, obviously. But let's look at it again. If you change your perspective, now that you've seen an electrical yo-yo, which one doesn't belong?
For me, it's still a yo-yo.
Still a yo-yo.
Still a yo-yo.
But if I showed you that, if I took the yo-yo up there and made that the subject and said, as far as it, take the strikeout number two now, put it up there and say, I might ought to make another transparency to this effect. And say, in respect to a yo-yo, which of the following is not needed?
Bulb.
Well, now, the bulb came on to light up. Has to have a battery to operate.
It has to be.
And it's got a wire. I don't need a plug. But see, changing your perspective, even with me trying to guide you into changing your perspective, do you see how hard it is to change it? To even think in terms of another perspective. And knowing that, I'm practicing. I'm not doing too well with this one myself. I'm practicing saying things like, well, why don't you explain it to me? Why don't you describe how you're feeling about it? Why don't you show me a picture of the thing or draw me an illustration? Why don't you give me some scripture passages that describe that theological concept? You see what I'm saying? I'm not able to perceive it, but I'm working on trying to perceive it. Well, let me give you another one. What I'd like you to do with this one now is count the number of times the letter F, A, B, C, D, E, F, the number of times the letter F appears in this one sentence. Okay? Two rules. Rule one is only one time through. Rule two is do it as quickly as you can, and when you finish, look over at me and I want to see how long it takes. You got it? The number of times the letter F appears one time through as quickly as you can. Somebody should be through by now. So two, three, half, three quarters, and everybody. Okay. There were two F's. Did you find, how many found two F's? There really are two. But how many found three F's? There really are three. There are three in there. How many found four? There really are four. How many found five? There really are five. How many found six? There really are six. For the ones who found two, it's evident that effective had two F's, wasn't it? For the three people, life had an F. I have never understood this. There's one, two, three. And the title of this transparency is, oh. Why didn't everybody in the group find six? Easy. That's one. Okay, some more reasons. Concentrating on the rules. What else? Pressure for time. Are you said the little things. Are odds important? Were you taught in school that odds really not all that important? What's it? Can you get the meaning without an odd? Effective manager, result, training, experience, life situations. Does that carry pretty much the meaning? But offs, suppose you leave them out. An effective manager is the result, years, training, and experience gained through real life situations. Did that really affect the meaning? Weren't you taught to kind of ignore the meaningless things? I think that in our culture that we primarily are. How many number did you get, if you don't mind me asking?
Three.
Okay. I would assume that it would have been much like ours is. However, if it had been someone that, from a culture whose language is not English, they might have taken a little more time to look for the F because it wouldn't be so prominent to them to overlook it. They would not have been trained to overlook it. Also, there are a few people, if you get a group of 40 or 50, there'll be somebody in here that says, well, F has a F sound, life. Effective, but of has a V sound. They were doing it on phonetics. So whatever the reason, do you see the point? Your perspective, your training, what have you been taught? How do you perceive it? Is it important or not? Just in the simple things like following the rules to come up with a number of answers. Let me give another illustration. I'm going to mention a word, and you tell me instantly what color it is in your mind, okay? And you say it together, if you will. You ready? Car. Blue. I heard red and blue. Was there a green anywhere? Or a white? Who said blue? I heard a blue. Why did you say blue?
I have no idea.
Do you like blue?
Yes, I do.
You like blue. What? Somebody said red. Why did you say red? Who said red?
Still
you what?
Still
good. Now we're getting down to the heart. How do you feel about the thing? I feel kind of, I hate to pay love the car, but I don't like the payments. So, you know, positive and negative. Well, it'll affect whatever, how you are feeling. We talked about, really, you see what we've been doing at some points in here, is how does it look to you? How do you perceive it? What do you see when the word is mentioned? And then, of course, how do you feel about what you see? Let's talk a little bit more about seeing. Now, this is just the results of one study, and it wasn't a very prominent study. There weren't tens of thousands. There were a few thousand. And according to this study, the best they could determine, you learned about 83% of what you know through your eyes. That's assuming you can see and hear both. About 11% through your ears, and of course the other taste, touch, and smell were insignificant amounts. You probably knew you learned most, but if you really want to be effective, what should you do? Visual, and if you want to top it off, you show and tell. That's what the elementary teachers learned. I don't know that they knew this statistic, but it's very important that if you can see it, then to help someone see it. Now, sometimes you can help them, by verbalizing, you can help them to see it. But other times you may want to draw a picture. You may want to demonstrate the thing. The first time that Gene Powell, a man that helped me in my personal growth many years ago, the first time he came by my house and asked me to be ready to go with him, I figured something was going to happen. What he had done prior to that, he had shared the bridge illustration and asked me to memorize selected verses, and I'd gone over the bridge. He knew that I could do that. And then he says, I'm coming by. I said, yeah, but where are we going? Well, we're going to go down to the snack bar on the base. I was in the military at the time. What are we going to do there? We're going to tell somebody about Jesus. You ever had that feeling? Absolute fear? Well, he said, all you'll be responsible for is to pray primarily, and at some point in there to give your testimony. Can you do that? I mean, yes or no, can you do that? I said, well, yeah, I think I can do that. He said, that's all I'm asking you to do. And we went out, and that's all that I did. Boy, is that vivid in my mind. He told me about it, then he showed it to me. Then we went out again, and I went out another time with a man named Ron York. I'll never forget that. Talk about a warrior for Jesus. Ron York fires big guns. And it made a deep, lasting impression. He wasn't just telling me about it from the platform. He took me out there and showed me that thing. Does that make a difference? The show and tell? It really does. Let's talk about retention. If you some information you were given, if all you did was hear it, after 3 hours, 70% recall. Visual is 72. It's not that big a difference after 3 hours. But look after 3 days. It's twice as much recall if you saw it as opposed if you only heard it. But if you see and hear, 65% recall. And then if you can experience it, guess what? Much higher than that. Let's see, it's been the better part of 35 years since I did very much with a trumpet. That's a chromatic scale. I can even remember a few of the songs. Typing. I had one little dinky course in typing. Now, I'm not that good. I am consistent. It's stroke, stroke, error, stroke, stroke, error. Three-quarter time, that's what I type in. But, you see, once you've seen it and heard it and practiced it, it makes a difference. And I'd submit that if you really want to be effective in communicating and getting the idea across, do that. I give a seminar sometimes, and I use the title before Jim came out with his book, Lifestyle Evangelism. And I like to not only present some of those key concepts, then I like to have a little get-together time and pair off and let's practice a few things in teams of two and let me come around with a little few suggestions here and there, and then the other person give the feedback. We set up some kind of the context for that. And then I like to pair off and go down to the university, go down to the shopping center, go down to the park, where there's people, go out to the military base. Now let's try it. And then after that's over, we'll all get together and share war stories. And anybody that trusted Jesus, bring the fruit along with you. We'll show them that you're not the only wild-eyed nut. There's three or four more of us back there that's a lot like that. Makes a difference. But to see and hear and do, very important. Sometimes you think you're getting across when you're not always sure. She's called on the little guy to recite Spot is a Dog, Run, Spot, Run. He says, personally, I think the author's style is redundant, repetitive, and lacking in narrative skill. So you're not, even after you've done the best you know, you're not always sure what the response is going to be. But you keep trying. You don't give up. You say, well, I'll simplify it. Well, you simplify it, but be aware that still there's going to be differences in perception. You might not perceive it. The little guy didn't perceive it the way the teacher did. So you say, here's good communication. I love fish, so do I. We have a lot in common. Is that clear communication? He's thinking about raising fish, and she's got in mind him inviting her out for a fish dinner. To him, eating the fish would be more cannibalistic. He would never agree to do that. So not only was that poor communication, that's the opposite end of the spectrum. That wasn't agreement at all. Well, then you say, okay, what I'll do, I really want to have an absolute, unequivocal dictionary definition, right? Can it be more precise than that? Surely I'll be understood. That's out of Webster's Collegiate Dictionary. It's a noun. Don't call what it is. Do you recognize it from that description? Well, let me help. A polyhedron is a multi-sided three-dimensional figure. That didn't help, did it? Having for its base, that's the bottom. A polygon, that's a two-sided. I mean, it's a one-dimensional figure at the bottom. A polygon. And for faces, that's the side of it. The faces are triangles and they come together in a common vertex, meaning a common point. Well, you know, some of you probably recognized it. Most of you would probably see it more readily if we put a picture of it up there. See, if I took care to describe it, well, it's simple. It's a polyhedron having for its base a polygon and for faces triangles with a common vertex. Surely you see that. Well, no, surely I don't see it. Well, that's very precise. Yeah, but man, I don't see it. I put that up there. One guy said, oh, yeah, now I see it. It's a palm tree. Well, you know, if it looks like a palm tree to you, that's probably what it is. You say, well, how am I going to look at it from somebody else's viewpoint? Some things you just simply cannot describe. Does anybody know what OSHA is? Right, there's some people that's emotionally attached to this group. If you've ever tried to build anything anywhere in the country, that's occupational safety and health. It's a part of the U.S. government, and we've over-empowered them to do all kinds of stuff. And if they want to harass you about your building, you may never get it finished. And they're checking every little thing you do, and you probably can't do it the way they want it done anyway. Well, sometimes they're not all that way now. But this is what a cowboy would look like if you tried to do everything OSHA would like you to do to get that cowboy. Of course, at that point, he's no longer a cowboy, is he? We've changed the perception so drastically. So drastically. Well, I think still visualizing it is probably going to be important. And again, let me talk some more about the nonverbal. And I'm going to try not to have a facial expression. Just the set of my jaw. Now I'm trying to look straight ahead. I'm going to turn over the side and I'm going to lower my jaw 15 or 20 degrees. Now when I look at you, you tell me what you think. What's it making you feel like about me? How am I? Okay, disagree. What are the feelings? Okay, what else?
Solemn.
Serious. Suppose I come into it. How'd you feel about that? How did you feel about that? Okay.
Critical.
Let's try putting it up.
Great thinker.
Alfred, looking at you. Arrogant. Yeah.
Suppose I come into it. Would you realize that that was only a few degrees difference in the set of the jaw? Did you have someone in mind when I said this? And you had somebody in mind when I said this. You called him Alfred Hitchcock. He does. The profile of him has the nose pointed up. Doesn't it? Next time you look at it. I hadn't thought that. I'll be able to use that one again. But it's true, isn't it? Would you like to analyze what you said about me? Arrogant, stuck up, words like that. They're all character traits. You are attributing to my character traits purely from the set of my jaw. Now, what application can you draw from that for you? Okay, what else? What are some of the other lessons might come to your mind?
It cuts off total communication skills. And just meeting somebody and I'll size them up and have them all read up and down, and, you know, where they're coming from and everything else, and it knocks off that communication.
How in the world do you communicate?
Well, Yeah, where do you start? I think we start by trying to get to know the person. If you make the focus on them and their perspective and their interests, ask some questions and give them, you practice giving the right feedback. See, the guy was arguing with me and I smiled at him. You ever tried to argue with a guy who smiles? Look at that. Would that be hard? Could you argue with that? You couldn't argue with that. I told this one young lad, I said, I seem to get the feeling that you would like for me to argue with you about that. I said, is that what you'd really like? Well, yeah, I guess so. I said, can't happen today. Not with me. I've decided not to argue. So I turned the thing away. And if you're feeling intensity from it, now you can have some, there are four or five things you can do to quieten the intensity. Suppose you're speaking, and this has happened in a group, it's happened one-to-one. I'm talking to somebody, and I'm talking to you, and three or four of you give me a frown. I got to think, well, was it something I said? Well, I'm not sure. Okay, let's say that's the setting. You're even talking to a person, or it can be in a small group. Large group it could be, but it's not so profoundly effective. Five things I could do. First thing I could do is pause and smile. Friendly. See, that's not a big smile. But it should indicate that I'm a bit friendly. A man that hath friends must show himself friendly. I'd like to be a little friendly. Second thing I do is I'd probably take just a moment to increase the distance between myself and you. I might even change my pattern and walk back, especially if I could think of something to do back here. Or in this case, I might walk over back here so that you're not feeling so threatened. Something I've said or done had put the pressure on you, some intensity factor, and I'd like to quieten that down. So the first thing I do is smile gently, and I had to give more distance. The third thing I do is that I lower my voice. See, when I get high-pitched, that implies that I'm all nervous and upset. I'm really intense about that. Well, I lower my voice. Another thing I do, and it's a voice factor too, is that I would probably speak a little more slowly. I lower it, I'd speak more slowly. And I would probably break eye contact if I'd been looking right at you, see, especially that. Now, I wouldn't say just to stare at the floor and not do anything. What I'd do is probably break and maybe look out the window or look over to the side a moment and come back. And I might just go back to somebody else and then come back and then see if I'm perceiving it. Those are some things that you might do, but I think if you put the focus on the other person, you've already prayed now and asked the Lord to give you speech that's always with grace. If it's not happening, then you need to pray through that. Lord, help! What in the world have I done? So you don't have to say that out loud. You can say that in your heart. Do you do that? Do you pray your way through the day? A lot of people have quiet time in the morning and, you know, intensive prayer time, and that's the end of it. I think it's a consistent daily walk. Do you tell the Lord, thank you for that parking place? You do for that. Thank you for that ticket I got. No, I didn't thank him for that. Well, maybe we ought to learn to, but there's the idea of praying your way through is so critical to what I'm trying to say, especially in the communication pattern, that you don't know what happened. You say, Lord, I don't know what happened. Show me what to do about it. Now, that's a simple thing, but if you'll give the Lord just a moment, in other words, you quieten down and break the pattern and listen. Have you ever really practiced that? I'm still working at it. Some years ago, I asked the Lord to help me to be able to have running conversation with Him throughout the day. Some months ago, I was over in King James, and there was a group of collegiates there, and I chose to have a meal with them. I really like them. Besides, I'm recruiting a lot of those lads and girls to go out for the Missionary Associates program. I got multiple reasons for being there. One bright young fellow to my left asked me a long, deep question. I had never heard the question, much less have thought of an answer. He asked it, and you know what I did? I took a drink just like that, a drink of iced tea on the table, and set it back down. And in that moment, I said, Lord, you know, I don't have the foggiest notion what the answer to that young fellow's question is. If you would like me to answer that, you'll have to give me your answer because I don't have one. And I put the glass down. Instantly, there was a passage of Scripture that I'd memorized came back to mind. And the Bible says, but the word is very nigh unto thee in thy mouth. And in thy heart, I just opened my mouth and out came the passage. And then I had a thought or two about it and we talked a moment about it and I paused. Another passage. open my mouth. Out it came. That wasn't my opinion. That was God's word. And, you know, I shared that. Then we talked some more. That happened three times. He says, you know, I've been asking that question for years, and you, and I, the first time he introduced the word you, I stopped him. I said, wait, you just introduced the word that doesn't belong there. You said me, and you were going to give me some credit for that, it appeared, and I wanted to stop you before you did it. I said, did you notice how long it took me to... No, he didn't notice. I said, man, I noticed. Then I told him what I'd done. I said, the truth is, you and I both took instruction this morning. We both learned the answer to that question, but I didn't have that much to do with it. All I did was ask. God said, ask, and what? You have not. Why? Isn't that the truth? Do you recognize that as truth in your own life? Whoever you are, there's probably many, many things you haven't asked for yet. Had you ever asked for speech that's always with grace, seasoned with salt? Have you ever asked to have a set of spiritual ears that you can hear a word behind you saying, this is the way, walk in it, when you turn to the right hand and when you turn to the left? I'd never done that. A man challenged me to do that. He said, you're not hearing God talk to you like that? And I said, no. He said, you ever ask? I said, well, no. He said, how in the world do you expect to have it if you don't ask for it? I didn't have an answer for that. He said, why don't you ask for it? That's Isaiah 30:21. Thine ears shall hear a word behind. Lord, give me a set of spiritual ears that I can hear your word behind me saying, this is the way. I prayed that in my life, and I think the answers I got over there at that table that day were simply a direct response. God answering that prayer. It's not that big a deal when you look at it from God's perspective. Ah, Lord God, behold, thou hast made the heaven and the earth by thy great power and stretched out arm, and there's nothing too hard for you. I think that's where it is. And I think I'm saying that throughout the... How do you get a handle on this? Well, you started this morning by praying a basic concept into your life. And I think you've got some principles and some think-through patterns of some key issues. And now as you set forward to... From here, I think you ought to ask the Lord to take from whatever you've seen and heard today, whatever He would have you to take, to apply to your life. And then when the problem comes up, you take a moment and pray in your heart, Lord, help me to see what to do with this. I don't know what to do. Sometimes it's for you to maintain silence. I ask for confirmation of that. I've been silent for a while, and I say, Lord, I don't get an answer. Do you want me just to be quiet about that? Sometimes it's clear-cut yes. If I don't get an answer, I hadn't got one. I've got one other little thing that I wanted to put in before we actually close this out. What man in here is about 5'8"? Somebody? No, everybody's taller. I'm the shortest one. How tall are you? 5'11". Well, you may be the nearest to my height. If you wouldn't mind helping me, please. It's not going to hurt a bit.
Okay.
It won't hurt. If you'd stand over there. And what's your name?
Gary.
Now, Gary, forget them. See how easy that was? What the setting is that we're down in the shopping center here. And I know Gary. We're not close friends, but we're acquaintances. And I see him. Well, Gary, hi. Man, it's good to see you. What's wrong with the communication? It's what? What's one way? What else wrong with it?
Too far away.
Okay, let's do something about that. Okay, put your hands by your side now. Now, don't pay attention. You stand still. And I'm going to come towards you. And all you're doing now, you're trying to get the feeling for when you think the distance for us to have a friendship communication is right. And I'll stop. I'll come slowly at this point. Okay, you tell me when. But you tell me when to stop, all right?
I think that's good.
That's good right there. Stick out your arm straight out. Out this way. Normally it's an arm's length and 4 to 6 inches among American males of the same height. Now he's about 2 or 3 inches taller than I am. That's still within the 4 to 6 inches. That's so consistent that I have never ever seen it fail. Thank you. Well, I got one more thing. I'm sorry. Let's try one more thing. Okay, now you get there and put your arm out and let me get in there. Okay, he said about like that. That still feels pretty good, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. Now I'm going to close your space envelope. Do you feel it?
Yeah.
He's felt it already, and I've only moved, 3 inches, 2 inches. Did you feel it? Look, I'm not even going to look at him. Do you feel that? Now you do, don't you?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, now if I come over here, how do you feel about that?
That's not as threatening.
That's not as threatening.
Yeah.
But that's a lot closer, but we changed the angle. This straight-on thing among American males is really disturbing. And if I came in there too close, Man, I don't like that. Have a seat. Thank you. I appreciate your help. I call that distance the space envelope. Have you ever been around somebody who violates your space envelope? Immediately you were identifying, weren't you? There's probably somebody comes to mind. Now, if you are the violator of the space envelope, then what? See, if I had to try to have a conversation with you up too close, how would you have felt? Would you have heard what I'm listening to? You wouldn't listen to that? I taught at Air University for some years, and I came in after one class, and I'm nervous. And a fellow sitting in my office, a fellow that worked for me at the time, was named Morado. He was Hispanic. And he says, "What's the matter with you?" I said, "Well, I just had a conversation with my Colombian officer, an officer from the nation of Colombia." He laughed. He said he violated your space envelope, didn't he? I said, "Violated it? He destroyed it." I mean, the room was small to start with, and I was up the front of the class, and the class finished, and he came right up and got right in my face, and, you know, I'm backing up systematically, and literally, I am against the wall, and he's still coming. He got up, put his shoulder against mine, and put his arm around my neck, and I heard zero. I don't have the foggiest what he said. I'm so nervous and tense, I can't even hear. I can tell if it's garlic or onions. I mean, we're in a filter position here. And, you know, I got to get out of that, and I came in there, I'm nervous. And he said, "That's the way it is in most of Latin America." He said, "If what he was doing was showing you that he cared. Had he not come in, for another Latin was there, the assumption would have been that he might have been... Some disagreement with you, or might even have been your enemy." Then I had a Korean officer. Boy, talk about spiritual perception. I'm in a group and he comes up. I'm just aware he's standing off their ways, and I turned around and he bowed and he said he was Colonel Hyun, and I remembered having met him. He said, "I have an understanding in here that you are a solid Christian." I said, "Yeah, that's true. How did you know?" "Well, it was just a spiritual understanding on his part." So then we shook hands again, and I moved in. I moved in to shake hands, and I stayed there, and he backed up. Well, then I came in again, and he backed up. I said, "Well, something must be going on here." Then I looked around at the other Koreans, and they were all 4 feet. See, then they don't bang heads. No, I don't know why that was. Later, when you got to know the person, they moved in culturally closer. But they weren't willing to get in there real close until much, much later. Now, if I said somebody my height, you're pretty tall. How tall are you?
6'4".
Six, that's pretty tall. Yes, to the fellow like me, that's quite tall. If you wouldn't mind helping me out and letting me call the shot this time. Let me show you how I feel about this one.
How you doing?
Okay, see, already, you see my trifocals are not operating. Because to look at him, you see, I've got to look up to really look him in the eyes. And that's uncomfortable. If I get my arm's length in 4 inches, doesn't that look weird? So I'll back off a little bit. I'll probably come back on another foot. Now, that's a lot more comfortable for me. His size is one thing. If he spoke loud, back it up a little more. Suppose he frowned at me. I don't like to frown. I got to be careful now that I'm not overfeeling intensity from him simply because of his height. I need to take that responsibility because he is not communicating a negative to me, but I as a short fellow might be feeling it. Thank you. Intensity is the...
Why is it that I have a tendency to always want to go, "How you doing, Bill?"
Well, now see, that one is a tall fellow. I'd probably look down the floor because if I try to look at you...
Does that make you feel...
It probably would make me feel a little bit, but here's what I'd do. I'd turn around the side and come in at an angle to you and take the intensity off of me and still not break yours because this was a genuine thing from you and you're not feeling anything negative from it. And I've made up my mind I'm not going to feel a negative off of it. How about that? Can you do that? Can you make up your mind you're not going to feel? I had a fellow work... I did some consulting some years ago in Georgia Power with a Georgia Power company. And there was a 6'3", I think it was. He came right up to me. He looked... I mean, man, he closed my space. I looked... I said, "Feet, you are going to stay right there. You're not going to move." He's looking down and I'm looking up. And he says, "You know, I've tried to get in with these guys around here and they seem to have a clique. They just won't accept me at all. You think you might could help me with that?" I said, "Yeah, I think that I probably could." I said, "First of all, why don't you stand there and let me get so I'm comfortable. And we talked about that. We talked about that frowning. Have you ever seen a fellow frowns all the time? It makes you look like I'm angry, right? Do I look friendly? I had a student one time frown all the time. Gave a speech. And everybody in class said, you look like you're unfriendly. I mean, that was being kind. And then I put him on TV after that. And he just got started and I hit the whole button. And there he is. He says, do I look like that? And I said, yeah, that's pretty much you. He said, what am I going to do about it? I said, well, smile. So he went. I said, no, that's really not what I had in mind. But the nonverbal, you see, can be affected by quite a number of things. Size is one. Color is another. Dark color tends to be more intense than light color. For most people, it may not be true in every culture. Hair color, light colored hair tends to be less threatening than darker colored hair. Lots of hair tends to be more threatening than less hair. Dark rimmed glasses tend to be significantly more threatening than light colored glasses. And there's some things you may not be able to do a thing about. You have a myopic correction. It's, 20/125? I've got trifocals, but mine make my eyes look bigger. Myopic correction makes your eyes look smaller. Now, to make your eyes look smaller, here's what it looks like. You see that? Can you see it in the back? Could you see it in the back? I just moved them 1/64 inch, but you don't have to move them very much. So if you feel somebody's feeling intense, you got it down. So you smile at me when I called on you, you smiled at me all the way through. You notice how much I relied on him? He has smiled at me throughout this whole thing. He's given me encouragement with that. His nonverbal feedback has been very pronounced. Let's see if I get the names. No. If somebody who knows him knows him more fully than I do would verify that that's probably the way he is across the board. He's a friendly fellow, makes me feel a lot more friendly, so much so that I'm drawn to him. Now, suppose that I was feeling uneasy about that and he didn't smile. See, if I saw his eyes as being smaller and he wasn't that kind of a person, I'm going to read some negative off of it. You see the point? There's some other things you cannot do anything about. So what you do is compensate for it. You smile. You back off. Give a little more space envelope. Do whatever else needs to be done. But I think the key is that we need to focus on the other person and do what we need to do to communicate to them so that they get our ideas and our feelings. And then I think we'll see Colossians 4:6 come right in the middle. That as you pray through it now and you know some principles and you set out practice them, that we'll trust God to make your speech. In fact, let's pray that now as we close. Lord, I would ask that for everyone here in this room that you would lift your word out of Colossians 4:6, that you'll give each one here speech that's directly from you, in your grace, in your spirit, prompted by you, speech that's always with grace, that you'll season that speech, both verbally and nonverbally, with salt so that it's palatable and acceptable, that our nonverbal will be encouraging and motivating and stimulating and friendly, and that we will draw people to ourselves by the speech you give us and then to you because of our life and testimony. And I pray that you'll help us to be careful throughout to praise you and thank you. And Lord, as we apply these, particularly in the area of evangelism and disciple making, as there's preaching and teaching and helping in the church, I would ask that in our own ministries and in our lives that you would lift a promise you gave your Israelite children in Leviticus when you said, I will have respect unto you and make you fruitful and multiply you and establish my covenant with you. And Lord, as you work in us and through us, please remind us to thank you and praise you. In Jesus' name, amen.